this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Jesse Trzynski, current president of the American Fisheries Society and director of animal health and welfare for Evoqua Farms. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Jesse Trzynski. Jesse is the director of animal health and welfare for Evoqua Farms and its sister company, Riverence. She leads fish health management for both companies, provides recommendations for improved operations, and ensures regulatory compliance. As a member of the Spring Salmon Group, Jesse provides science leadership and research project management support for the company's various aquaculture-related endeavors. Before joining the private sector, Jesse was an associate professor at the Southern Illinois University and a fish pathologist supervisor for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. She received her bachelor's degree from Western Washington University and her PhD from Southern Illinois University. And to cap it all off, this past August, she was sworn in as the president of the American Fisheries Society. Welcome to the podcast, Jesse.
Hi, Nick. It's great to be with you.
So when you're not being the president or president-elect of the American Fisheries Society, what is your day job?
So my day job is to ensure that the Spring Salmon Group makes the best science-based decisions that we can. So our company includes a couple of sort of subsidiaries. We have a breeding company based in Washington. We produce Atlantic salmon, coho salmon, and rainbow trout eggs for sale to commercial food fish operations throughout the world. And we also have a rainbow trout grow-out operation based in Idaho. We're actually the second largest producer of rainbow trout and steelhead for the table for the food fish market in the country. So, of course, these two large operations involve a lot of fish science and other types of science, to be truthful. And my job is to make sure that we use the best science available to ensure that our operation is successful. That means using biology and other aspects of fishery science to raise our fish to perform well on the farms, to produce a good quality product for our customers, and to do all of that in a way that's not only economically viable, but environmentally sustainable. So my job is to use my background in fish health and nutrition and science in general to make sure that we use, as I said, the best information available and make good choices.
In my eyes, it's easy to see how someone would want to get into the fisheries management part of the fishery science. How did you become interested in fish health?
My interest in fisheries didn't actually start with fish health. That's something that I kind of grew into as my career progressed. But I first became interested in aquaculture when I was in the middle of my undergraduate program. And essentially, I had what I consider my quarter-life crisis. So I had been going to school thinking that I was going to become a marine biologist, like a lot of other people of my generation. And I got to the point where I realized that the path that I was on might not lead to the career goals that I was hoping for. I really wanted to do something that I could wrap my arms around and at the end of the day, feel like I've made a difference. And certainly there's a ton of people who do that kind of work in marine biology. My specific interest was in deep sea hydrothermal vents and kind of this very, very esoteric little niche within marine biology. And I thought, you know, maybe someday if I work really, really hard and do the best quality science I can, maybe I can have a Discovery Channel special someday, you know, and that would be really cool. But is that enough for me? And so I was kind of searching around for something that would make me feel that I'd have more meaning in my career, something, again, that meant something to me personally. And it was around that time I was taking a course in fisheries that talked about aquaculture. And I thought, okay, wait a minute, here's a way that I can use my background in biology and math and chemistry and my interest in fish. I can use all these different things and feed people and make a difference as far as the seafood supply, reducing pressure on capture fisheries, and that really resonated with me. And so at that point, I thought, okay, here's the path I want to put myself on. And so I did my PhD focused on aquaculture and have been a part of the industry and the research community in aquaculture ever since. So yeah, it started as a general interest in marine science and then kind of went in a different direction, but I couldn't be happier. I have a great job where I feel like I make a difference every day, not only for the people that I work with, but for the resource as well.
That shift from marine biology to freshwater biology happened while you were at Western Washington University. How did you get from the northernmost university in the contiguous U.S. to southern Illinois and kind of the forgotten part of Illinois?
Yeah, so I wish I had a really compelling answer that, you know, that would really, you know, speak to your audience as far as, you know, doing the right thing and making the right choices as far as grad school and careers and that sort of thing. But it's not really how it happened for me. When I started looking for graduate programs, I intentionally started looking in the Midwest because my family's from there. So I grew up in Washington State, but most of our family lives in Minnesota and North Dakota. And at that point, my family had relocated back to the Midwest. And so I wanted to do a graduate program in aquaculture, and I wanted to be a little closer to home, closer to my folks and the rest of the family. And so that's how I ended up in Illinois. I wish I could say it was strictly driven by the nature of the work and everything else, but being close to family had a big part to do with it. Now, obviously, the decision worked out really well, and I had a great advisor and a fantastic project, and I liked Illinois well enough to stay there for quite some time, but it was a little bit more happenstance than maybe I'd be totally comfortable admitting.
It wasn't the scenery surrounding Carbondale that drew you?
As a Western girl, I'm going to say no, although I did have a lot of fun hiking and kayaking and fishing in and around Southern Illinois. There's a lot of great landscape there to be taken advantage of, but I will fully admit to feeling a lot more at home living back in the West again.
It's no mountains, but the Shawnee National Forest is a lot of fun to get lost in.
Yeah, absolutely. And get lost is the right way to say it. You know, some of those Tupelo Forest type swampy types of atmospheres, like you can, if you're not paying attention to where you're going, you can get lost pretty quickly. All the scenery starts to look pretty similar.
So after you finished your PhD at Southern Illinois, did you just jump straight over to an assistant professor?
So not exactly. There was about a year that I was working as sort of a postdoc. I think my title was assistant scientist or something like that. So I was still working in the same lab for Chris Kohler. He was my PhD advisor. He's also a past president of AFS. And so I used that time really to kind of branch out into not a totally different area of science, but really push some of the research questions that we had been asking in the lab previously into some new directions. And thankfully, that's what led to new areas of research for the program that I was able to, you know, expand on once I was able to secure a faculty position. So it wasn't an immediate transition. There was a little bit of a 1 year gap there, but I'm really glad that that was there because that allowed me to develop some of those ideas that I was really able to take to the next level once I had my real job.
Your career so far to this point has been mostly academic background. When was the first point along there that you got involved with the American Fisheries Society?
So it really began when my graduate work began, because when I started in the program at SIU, I don't know if it was my first day, I think it was definitely the first week, and my advisor, Chris Kohler, said, okay, welcome to the program, go join AFS. And I didn't know exactly what that meant at the time, but I'm so grateful that he did that. You know, he said, this is what we do if we are fisheries professionals. We're a part of this organization. And when I say we're a part of it, we don't just pay our dues and read the magazine and the journals periodically. We get involved. We serve the society. It's going to make a difference. And that was probably the best advice he gave me throughout my career to this point. Don't get me wrong. He gave me a lot of good guidance throughout my PhD work and since then. But as far as what's made the biggest difference for my career, it was that advice to join AFS. Every job that I've had, every major project that I've been a part of, one way or another, it connects back to AFS. And somebody I met at a conference or a paper that I read or somebody that I knew because we were both involved in AFS.
Or a podcast that you've appeared on.
Or a podcast, that's right.
So did you always have aspirations of eventually becoming the AFS national president? Was that just something that fell in your lap, or how did that whole thing develop?
Well, so I wouldn't say that it just fell into my lap. I definitely did a lot of work in the trenches, so to speak, developing the skills and the network that I think brought me to the point of being at the society's highest office. But I don't know that I would say it was something that I aspired to from the beginning. What I would say is that at each level that I got involved with AFS, whether that was serving as a student subunit president or, editing a newsletter for a section, at each level that I got involved, I learned something, I met some people, and I had fun. And I did something that was fulfilling. And so it kind of, I don't know, I suppose it became a little bit addictive in that the more that I did, the more that I wanted to do for the society. I guess it was just kind of a natural progression in my mind to stay involved in AFS and serve at higher levels. So that's ultimately led me to where I am now. Yeah, I guess it was kind of a natural evolution. I'm really grateful that I have this opportunity to lead the society and to hopefully make my mark and make a difference for fisheries professionals in this role.
As part of your presidential duties, you were recently able to travel to Australia for their society's annual meeting. How was your trip?
Oh, it was fantastic. So the meeting was in Melbourne, Australia, which thankfully I've had a chance to visit before. It's a beautiful city. And this was my first time attending the Australian Society for Fisheries Biology meeting, however. And what I would say is probably the thing that struck me the most about attending that meeting is that, of course, the places are different, the systems are different, the species are really different. They work with a lot of really cool fish there. But so much of what was discussed was the same. There's so much commonality between the things that we talk about and struggle with within the American Fishery Society and the things that they are struggling with and working with and trying to change down in Australia. So things like science communication, and how do you get a public that has, in many ways, declining science literacy, how do you get them to understand fishery science? And beyond understanding, how do you get them to care about fisheries resources? How do you establish and maintain the social license to operate? These are things that were really common themes throughout the Australian meeting. And I know that that's something that anyone who's attended an AFS meeting in recent years would attest to. That's a common theme for us as well.
So you went to Australia. Do you have any other trips to foreign lands planned or just the regional meetings throughout the U.S.?
Well, it's both a blessing and a curse when you're AFS president that you have a lot of travel obligations. So I say it's a blessing because you get to go to some amazing places domestically and internationally and meet people who are just as passionate about fishery science as you are. And that's a real privilege. It's a bit of a curse in that it can be a challenge to balance your AFS travel with obligations at the office and obligations at home, but the balance is definitely in the positive. So it's been really fulfilling for me to be able to go to, in the past year or so, to Australia, to China, and to South Korea. And I'll be traveling to Japan and the UK and perhaps South America as well in the coming 6 to 12 months, I guess. So a lot of trips planned, a lot of other organizations to visit. And that's in addition to the divisional meetings and as many section and chapter meetings as I can make it to. So like I said, it's a lot, but it's such a privilege. It's really an honor to go and see what folks are doing and how hard they're working and how innovative they are to try to conserve fisheries resources.
Like you just said, the presidency isn't all glitz and glam, and sometimes you even have to do a little bit of work, such as preparing a plan of work for your years of the presidency. What will be some of the issues you'll be working on or trying to improve in the next year?
So one of the things that's a really high priority to me, and I think for the rest of the AFS leadership, is making sure that AFS provides its members with the tools and resources they need to do their jobs the best they can. And continuing education is a really important part of that. Now, we offer a selection of courses, a wide range of courses, really, that address everything from statistics to electrofishing and all sorts of other what I'll call hard skills that are relevant for fisheries. What we haven't taught as much of are courses in soft skills, things like conflict resolution, meetings management, things like that. And the truth is that for a lot of young fisheries professionals that are just getting out into the workforce, it's those soft skills that can really make the biggest difference. For instance, you might have a lot of really great technical skills in otolith microchemistry, let's say, But then you go to work for a state agency, and maybe the first thing that you're going to be asked to do is to go facilitate a public meeting. Those are really different skill sets, right? And so I think that there are some programs in the country that teach classes and those sorts of things, but I think it would be a stretch to say that that's an integral part of most fisheries training programs. And so I think AFS is in a really good position to help not just young professionals, but really all fisheries folks to close that gap between the training that they receive in kind of the formal setting in the classroom and some of that additional soft skills training that they may need to be successful in their careers. So we're going to be developing a suite of courses over the next year with the intent of rolling them out at the 2019 meeting in Reno and then building the suite of courses from there to really help folks develop those skills in interpersonal relations, like I said, soft skills. I've heard people say that in fisheries, we hire you for your technical skills, but we'll fire you for your interpersonal skills, meaning that if your interpersonal skills aren't up to par, you're not going to have a real long career path in the industry or in the profession. So again, I think AFS is in a really good position to help folks close that gap. So that's one of the things that we'll be working on over the next year. Another area that we'll be focused on is making fisheries as relevant and timely to the public as we can. As I was saying earlier, science literacy isn't necessarily a high priority for a lot of members of the public. We'd like to help them understand that not only does science matter, but fisheries science matters. Fisheries matter to us for all sorts of reasons, or they should matter to us. Fish are food. Fish are a source of recreation. Fish are a part of functioning ecosystems. There's all sorts of reasons that fish should matter on an everyday basis to just about every person. Whether they like to go fishing or not really doesn't matter. Do they like to have a great livelihood? Because fish contribute in one way or another to that well-being. So we'd like to focus over the next year on ways to get that message out, to make fisheries science the importance of thriving fisheries, make that message accessible, understandable, and resonant with the average member of the public. So we'll be focused on science communication a lot as well. So those are two of the boldface priorities for the next year. But there are a number of other things that we're going to be doing too. Some things that are maybe focused a little bit more internally within the profession. One of those things is improving the quality of the publishing process. So anybody that's ever published a paper knows how much work it is, how hard it is. And if you haven't done a lot of it, probably the hardest part of it is just understanding the process. AFS publishes a whole stable of journals in different subject areas, and we can do a lot to enhance the authorship experience when they send their manuscripts to us. We can't guarantee publication, but we can guarantee a fair, predictable experience. And again, anybody that's spent any time publishing can tell you, just getting a fair shake is the best thing you could hope for and something that you don't always get when you send your papers to other journals. So we'll be working to really strengthen our journals to focus on the authorship experience.
A few weeks ago, I recorded an episode with Endora Roberts, an undergraduate student in fisheries. And in her opinion, the two largest issues in the field were that the field of fisheries does kind of a bad job of communicating science. And you mentioned that AFS is going to be addressing that in the coming future. Another thing she mentioned was a low diversity. She had the feeling that she would want some more female friends in the field. What steps is AFS taking to try to improve diversity in the field of fisheries?
I think your guest had a fair point about the diversity within the society and within the profession at large. I think we have a fair amount of ground to make up before we are truly representative of the fishery stakeholders groups and really the public at large. I don't think that we should just focus on angling groups or fishermen, commercial fishermen as our stakeholders. We really, as a profession, serve the entire community. And until our profession looks like that community and has the perspectives of all the folks that live in those communities, I don't think we will have really achieved much in terms of where we need to be with respect to diversity. So, I mean, I think AFS has always tried to be a welcoming home for fisheries professionals of all stripes, but I know that we've fallen short of that in many ways and many times. Over the past year, before I started my term as president, past President Steve McMullen had as one of his primary elements of his plan of work was to address the issues of diversity and inclusion within the society and to try to address that problem. Why don't we have more women? Why don't we have more underrepresented groups within our ranks? What can we be doing to make sure that those folks not only feel welcome, but want to be a part of our organization and the profession? Like so many big initiatives like that, you can't get it done in a year's time. That's something that really kickstarted with Steve's term as president and is continuing on into my term and will undoubtedly continue on into years into the future. So as part of that, we have a special committee focused on diversity and inclusion to try to really tease apart this problem. I think as fisheries scientists, we try to be pretty quantitative, pretty science-driven in, I would like to think, most aspects of our life, and this is no different. So we're trying to dissect the problem and really understand it so that we can do things that will move the needle, that will make meaningful change. For example, I think there was a lot of emphasis early on with respect to diversity issues on what I'll call the pipeline. So making sure that undergraduate and graduate programs had women, had minorities, had underrepresented groups within their ranks. And I think we've come a long way in that regard. I think if you look at a typical fisheries lab at pretty much any institution these days, there may still be some ground to be made up in terms of ethnic diversity, but in terms of gender diversity, they're pretty evenly split. In fact, I know a lot of programs where there's actually more women graduate students than there are men. I think in a lot of ways, many of those challenges have been met in terms of the training programs and educational programs. What we're not seeing is that level of representation and inclusion translating into the profession and translating into leadership roles within the profession. You know, we're again, pulling this problem apart, trying to understand the issues in as quantitative manner as we can. And what we're finding is that this isn't really a pipeline problem anymore. We're getting lots of diverse folks through training programs. Now, the question is, okay, how do we recruit them into the profession? And how do we make the profession such that they want to stay, that they stay in the profession and they don't drop out or do something else with their careers, with their lives, for whatever reason? That's not something that is a unique issue for AFS or for the fisheries profession. Most fields in the sciences have this same kind of issue, and they're struggling with it. They're grappling with it the same way that we are. So we're not alone, but that, of course, isn't terribly encouraging that lots of professions, lots of groups have diversity issues. That's not really good news. But if there is a silver lining there, it's that we can learn from each other. So we can look to other professional organizations and see, what have you guys tried? What have you done to try to make your organization more welcoming, more inclusive, more representative, and learn from mistakes and implement what's working? So again, we don't have to necessarily reinvent the wheel here. And so that's something that I know that committee is working on presently, reaching out to other organizations, as well as looking within the fisheries profession for solutions.
From my experience, looking at the people working in the field, the biologists and the management biologists and research biologists for each state, you see a lot of males, but going to meetings, both divisional and national meetings, it's a pretty balanced group at the meetings between male and female attendees. So I think the shift is going to be happening here in the coming years, more females getting into the field than not.
Yeah, and that may be the case. You know, it may be that it just takes time for those generations, those cohorts of more, I guess, gender-balanced groups of fisheries professionals coming out of training programs to get into those careers and move up through the ranks and find themselves into those leadership roles. Certainly, it does take time to see a transition that happens at one stage of a career to kind of filter up through the other kind of professional stages. But I think there's quite a bit of evidence to show that we should be seeing more of it in the profession and in leadership roles within the profession than we are currently. So why is that? Why is it taking longer, or why is it just not happening to the extent that we would expect based on the number of women and minorities that are coming through and getting degrees in fisheries or related fields? So, it's a really tough problem, but it's something that I would hope is obvious, matters a great deal to me. I hope that I'm living up to the challenge that was set forth by some of the trailblazers, women that came through and carved out a career in fisheries when that wasn't such an easy thing to do. I hope that I'm living up to their expectations and doing right by them. But just as importantly, I hope that I'm, you know, making that path that much easier to travel for the young women and other underrepresented folks that are coming in behind me. I realize that it means a great deal for young women to see someone that looks like them, that may have some of the same experiences that they've had in a leadership role. I take that responsibility pretty seriously. So diversity inclusion is going to be an ongoing part of what's happening at leadership within AFS, not just during my term as president, but for those that are coming in the years behind me.
So AFS will be working on improving diversity and improving communication between science and the public. One area that a lot of meeting attendees might be interested in is, are there any plans on increasing the amount of beer tickets available at meetings?
Yeah, the number of drink tickets is always of prime concern to our meeting attendees. Yeah, no, I know you're asking that question somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, what are we doing to make sure that folks get the most that they can get out of our national or our divisional or chapter meetings, for that matter? I think that folks do get a lot out of our meetings. So I was just reviewing the results of the survey about Atlantic City. And, you know, there are some things that people just absolutely loved about the meetings. And everyone was talking about how much they enjoyed the plenaries and some of the events and the networking opportunities, all really good science to see and immerse themselves in. But there are other things that we can continue to do better. It's a little bit of a catch-22, but one of the challenges that we have is the size of our meetings. Because our meetings have, you know, anywhere from, you know, 1,500 to 4,000 attendees, many of whom are giving poster or oral presentations, that means there's a lot of science on, you know, that's there to be seen, which is great, but it also means that you oftentimes have to choose between two talks that you really want to see because they're at the same time, or two sessions or symposia that are similar topics, and, you know, you might not be able to run back and forth between to catch everything. It's a problem, but I think in some respects, it's a good problem to have because that means when we come to science available, and we're sharing it with each other. So, you know, how do our attendees together, how do we give folks a chance to share the really cool stuff that they're working on, but how do we keep our meetings manageable and let folks see as much as they possibly can while they're with us at the annual meeting? And there are a lot of different ideas that we're talking about, you know, whether it's limiting the number of special symposia or trying to, you know, deal with it from kind of a scheduling perspective, or putting symposia that we think might be on sort of related topics or topics that people might be, if they're interested in one, they're likely to be interested in another. Can we put those in their proximity within the convention center? These are all things that we've talked about. Some of these options have legs, some of them really don't. But I guess the bottom line, you know, what I would want fisheries folks, AFS members to know is that we hear you. We're always trying to come up with ways to make our meetings the most valuable that we can. So yeah, we're always working to try to make things more enjoyable, more edifying, so that people really come away from the meeting feeling like it was money and time well spent. I think they do feel that way now, but we don't want to rest on our laurels. We just want to be pushing that envelope and giving people more. I think this next meeting in 2019 is a good example of pushing that envelope. So for the Reno meeting, it's time that AFS will meet with the Wildlife Society at the national level. So there are a few chapters that at the state level that they commonly do this. So the wildlife folks and the fisheries folks will have their annual meetings together, but it's never been done at this scale. And so if we do this right, this could be the largest convening of natural resource professionals maybe in the history of natural resource professionals. And I think it's going to be a really unique opportunity to have all the folks in the room to address some of these interdisciplinary problems, or interdisciplinary, as I'll say, Whether we're talking about landscape scale conservation, well, you need wildlife and fisheries people in the room to do that. Or using sharing techniques and technology, whether that's from tags and monitoring equipment to track animal movement, or statistics that, you know, maybe the wildlife folks are using some new whiz-bang approach that the fisheries folks don't know about, or vice versa. I think there's going to be a lot of really cool opportunities for cross-pollination at Reno. I will say that it's been a challenge to plan. So when I say AFS is always trying to push the envelope to provide a better quality experience at our annual meetings, sometimes that's a lot of hard work. Things like, when should we be meeting? Well, when you meet with another organization, that gets a little bit trickier because different typical schedules. So AFS usually meets sometime in August and September. Wildlife meets in October. Well, even just figuring out the date we wanted to have our meeting was one extra layer of complexity that wouldn't otherwise have to deal with. But you know what? We think it's worth it because for all of the logistical and administrative things that go on behind the scenes, we think we're going to deliver a really unique, maybe even kind of a once in a career, once in a generation opportunity to be with folks who are active and passionate about natural resource conservation and have a chance to learn from each other and build these networks beyond what we normally be able to do if we just stayed within our little fisheries world.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to going to Reno, and I enjoy going to all the national meetings. And my little bit of advice for anyone that, like I tongue-in-cheek joked about the beer tickets, the smaller the meeting, the more free beer you get. So get involved in some of those smaller committees, and you'll have more beer than you know what to do with.
Yeah, no, it's the bit about getting involved. I will say this, like my advisor told me, don't just be a dues paying member, be an active involved member. And maybe that means you score a few extra drink tickets for helping out with the committee. But really what I think folks get out of it is that network. It's knowing somebody so that when you walk the grand social, it's not just a bunch of strangers who are nervous to go chat with. You know a few people from that committee or from your chapter that you can go and chat with and feel comfortable. You know those people that work in these different areas that, boy, if a problem comes up in your agency or in your office, you're like, you know what? I think I know somebody that might be able to help us with this. And you can pick up the phone and strike up that conversation. You know, that's the value of AFS. It's building that community. And I know it's a really hard thing for folks who don't really have a huge network yet to fully understand what that means, but take advantage of those annual meetings, chapter meetings, whatever meetings you attend, whether they're AFS meetings or not, or get involved as a volunteer, you won't regret it.
Well, now the tough part of the interview is over and we are down to the final five questions.
The final five? Oh my.
This is a group of five questions that I ask each of the expert guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Yeah, what's my favorite fish? That's a really deceptive kind of question because it seems so simple. But if you work in fisheries, it's really hard to pick just one. You know, every species that you encounter, you know, every single one of them is its own little evolutionary miracle. So picking a favorite is tough. I've done a lot of work with hybrid striped bass and other freshwater fish back during my days in the Midwest. And now I work with salmonids, and they're all amazing. But I'm going to say that my favorite fish is the humble goldfish, and I'll tell you why. I've always kept goldfish. They're a great little pet. I've enjoyed keeping them to this very day. In fact, I'm sitting in my office right now, and I have a 70-gallon aquarium, and it is chock full of all sorts of different fancy goldfish. My background in fish nutrition, I might like to think of myself as being a big time scientist, but in truth, I just really like feeding fish, and my goldfish are really good eaters. So I'll say that, at least for now, those are my favorites. If you ask me tomorrow or next week, I might have a different answer, but for now, I'll say goldfish.
What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
My favorite memory from my career thus far. There's been a lot of great moments. You know, some of them have been my moment. Some of them have been my students' moment when they had their opportunity to shine. There's been a lot of really great high points. But I will say one project that I'm especially proud of is work that I did when I was with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game to help resolve a problem that we had encountered with a new hatchery that had come online. So this is a hatchery that was constructed to produce Snake River sockeye salmon smolts. And in the hatchery, the fish looked beautiful, but they really struggled when the fish were released. We were trying to figure out why these fish were having such trouble during their immediate release and out migration. And we were able to do a series of experiments, nothing especially sophisticated. It was pretty straightforward research to kind of narrow down the possible contributing factors. But we ultimately were able to determine that there was a pretty major difference in water chemistry between the hatchery and the release site where we were taking these smolts. Now, both locations, the water quality was great and the fish could live and thrive in either one of them. It was just the harsh transition from one to the other that seemed to be really stressing the fish out and causing them to have so much trouble. And once we mitigated for that problem, then the program really seemed to be taking off. And this past year had great success, record survival for out migration for Snake River sockeye. So I would say that's probably one of my easily my top five moments, if not the top moments so far in my career. Being able to work with smart people, dedicated people, and to be able to focus on a really important issue and ultimately use good solid science to solve a problem. That's what we're all supposed to be doing in fisheries, right? And so it was nice to be able to see that through from start to finish and resolve a problem.
Your career is kind of taking you all over. You're from Washington and you did some work in the Midwest and you've traveled to China and Australia, like you mentioned. What is your dream job or dream location to work in?
I have my dream job, I think. I've lived in a lot of different places and I've done a lot of different things. I've worked in academia. I've worked for a state agency. Now I work in the private sector. And every single one of those jobs, when I was in the job, I think it was my dream job. It was what I wanted to do and what was really professionally fulfilling for me at the time. But I think what I've learned maybe most is that from this whole experience and the transitions that I've undergone is that there's all sorts of ways and all sorts of different careers that can provide the opportunity to do really meaningful fishery science. You know, I think there's a little bit of a perception, I think, in academia, especially when you're working on your PhD, that you think that, well, maybe academia, that's the ultimate goal. And if I don't get to be a professor someday, then I will have somehow fallen short. And it's not the case. I mean, there are people who love academia and do amazing work within those careers. And there's people who love their jobs and do amazing work in all sorts of other different types of career paths. So there's all sorts of ways to be successful. And so what I do right now gives me the chance to use all sorts of different parts of my brain to work on all sorts of different types of topics that pertain to fisheries and aquaculture. It's really stimulating. I feel like I'm, like I said earlier, making a difference every day for my colleagues, for our business, for natural resources. I mean, who would ask for more than that? That's pretty amazing. I'm very fortunate to have the job that I have now. So yeah, I think I have my dream job. In 5 years or 10 years, maybe my dream job will be something else. But yeah, as long as I can have a job where I feel like I'm making a difference for fisheries conservation, for wise use of aquatic resources, I think all of that counts as a dream job.
You're working in your dream job. But if money was not an issue, what is your dream project that you would like to work on?
Wow, my dream project. That's a really hard question. I'm not sure I have a good answer to that. I'm not sure. So I guess one thing that we're actually working on a little bit right now within our company is to try to fill in some of the gaps. Again, to help aquaculture businesses and fisheries professionals do their job as best they can. So one of the things that's a limiting factor for aquaculture operations and fisheries generally is there isn't a lot of expertise within the veterinary community for fish. So there are veterinarians that specialize in fish, but there aren't very many of them. And it's something that certainly within the fish health profession and in that community, we need more of. So if money were no object and we could create a program to help veterinarians learn about fish and give them the training and experience they would need to help, you know, folks that are raising fish or working with fish in the field, I think that'd be really fantastic. But yeah, it would take a lot of time and money and resources. But hey, you gave me the option to dream in Technicolor, so I'm going to do it. And I'll say that, yeah, creating a school of aquatic medicine at a veterinary program would be pretty amazing.
And the final one, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I thought you said these were simple questions. there is one thing that I would like to, I would like folks to know. I guess I'll say this, and I'm not sure that it's especially profound, but it's something that I think has helped me in my career, and I think has kind of helped those around me to understand fisheries too, and that's to share your passion, to share your story. I think a lot of people, when you tell them that you work in fisheries, or that you are a biologist, or you know, any of these types of ways that we might describe our careers, I think a lot of people kind of scratch their heads, like, why would you want to do that as a career? You know, and it's really hard for people to support things that they don't understand. And so I think it's been really helpful to me, you know, to when I talk to my friends or my family or a person I'm standing in line next to at the grocery store, if we start talking about, oh, what do you do for a living? Here's what I do. I work in fisheries and aquaculture, and here's why it's amazing. You know, let your passion, let your nerd flag fly. Let people know why what you do matters so much to you and why it should matter to them. And, you know, the idea that people don't care what you do, they care why you do it. I think we forget about that sometimes, and we just talk about what we do, but we don't always remember to tell folks why we do it and why we care so much about it. So I think if folks could do that more often, people would be, I guess, more aware of and more appreciative of fisheries resources and fisheries scientists.
I had a friend tell me once after we got talking about what I do, and at the end of it all, she said, well, I guess everybody's a nerd about something. So everyone's a nerd, so just share what you're nerdy about.
Right. Everybody's a nerd about something. I love that. And it's absolutely true. So, yeah, don't be ashamed to let people know. Don't be ashamed to nerd out about fish. People love it.
Well, Jesse, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your vision for AFS. And perhaps we'll have you or Doug Austin back on in the future to preview the next meeting.
That would be fantastic. And thank you so much for what you do, putting the word out about good fish science and good fish scientists.
If people want to find out more information about AFS or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Being that I travel a lot, usually email is the best way to reach me. So it's Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at Riverence, R-I-V-E-R-E-N-C-E.com.
If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Listen in next week when I will talk to Mark Gaydon from the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and hear about their work controlling sea lamprey. You can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 13th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, share your passion.